at hand. We have to finish up last week's topic, the cow that wouldn't die, and then move into Copernicus. I don't know if I could ask you to take this. Someone might be brave enough to sit next to me. We'll see. Steven sits next to me. He has no problem. So again, last time we talked about the scientific revolution, the scientific method, and the challenges that we face when scientific evidence, scientific theory, seems to conflict with what the Torah teaches. And we talked about it from a philosophical standpoint, the idea of divine authority versus human declaration, human observation, human logic, as well as the issue of particular ideals of Judaism that may come under fire from a scientific claim. We talked about substantive issues and the fact that the scientific method may not be up to the same level of proof that we usually demand in the thinking of halakha of Jewish law. And then we talked about extraneous factors as well that may create conflict, like Christian pressure as one example. And we outlined at least four approaches, if not six, approaches to dealing with this, ranging from saying, okay, the science is wrong and the scientists are wrong, to saying the sages were right and the discovery is right. The sages were working with deeper information, or the sages are right and the discovery is right, but the world has changed since those times, as well as the idea that maybe the sages worked with the knowledge of their time and according to the science of that time, but they weren't necessarily correct in assessing reality. There's more to be said about that, but I want to talk about the particular case of the cow that wouldn't die, because it's going to give us another approach to look at as part of this conversation. So if you take a look on your sheets, and there are new sheets, I still have some here for anyone who doesn't have. Does everyone have?
You want to pass through a sheet?
Thank you. This is a story from, as you see, 13th century Spain. Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, authority in Jewish law in Muslim Spain in that generation, has the following question put to him. And this relates to what's called a trefa. I think I already mentioned last week what a trefa is, but just to remind people, literally the root, tet resh pei in Hebrew, is something that is torn. And it's a term that's used often for prey. There's a predator, and then there is prey with an e. And the trefa is the animal that has been torn or that has been prey to an attack, such that it is mortally wounded. So that if an animal is a trefa, even if you shecht it, it's not kosher. The trefa will never be kosher, and that term, in fact, has come to be used for non-kosher in general. We talk about something that is non-kosher as being treif. The term was borrowed from there. So the Talmud actually lists the type of diseases, injuries, conditions, which will render an animal a trefa. And that's what comes up here. The other word you need to know in order to read this is the word aver. The word aver means what in Hebrew?
Organ.
An organ, that's one translation. Sometimes you'll see it translated as a limb. It doesn't really admit of an English translation. It's a word for which there is no English translation. And the reason for that is because it actually refers to different types of units within the body. In the sense that sometimes an aver is what we would call a limb, sometimes an aver is what we would call an organ, some of the avarim are bones. The Talmud teaches, it's a Mishnah, that there are 248 avarim in the body. And it lists what those are, and some of them are bones, and some of them are organs. It doesn't really admit of a translation, and that's why I just left the word aver in number one. It's a part of the body. Okay, so the question that's asked is, an animal was found to have an extra aver, the term in the Hebrew is yeteret, like the word yoter, and it was from one of those avarim, aver plural, which renders the animal a trefa, in a place which should render it a trefa. So the animal had some kind of an extra unit of some kind, a sixth toe, so to speak. Not really, because they don't have five, but you know what I'm saying. The animal had some kind of an extra organ such that it's on the list as a trefa. It was clarified, says the questioner, that 12 months had passed, and yet it was still alive. And we have a general rule that animals that have a trefa, animals with one of these conditions, will die within 12 months. So he says, look, it has one of the signs to make it a trefa, but it survived 12 months. Something's wrong. So, yes, would we say that since 12 months passed, it is not a trefa, and it is kosher? For the Talmud says, it's Chulin, page 58, that a trefa cannot live 12 months. Although I have seen and heard that some permit this and are lenient, the questioner says, I wish to know your view. That's the problem. Here I have, right in front of me, an animal which seems to defy what the Talmud tells me is true. So it's not a matter of scientific theory against the Torah. It's a matter of evidence. This is what I see in front of me, and it's before the scientific revolution, and it's before the modern scientific method, but fundamentally it's no different from a case in which somebody would say, well, you know, the rabbi said that the moon is actually, I'm not saying the rabbi said this, but I'll give you an example, the moon is a spiritual entity and not a physical body, and then lo and behold, people landed on the moon. It's the same sort of a question. I have something I have observed to be true, that seems to conflict with what the sages are telling me. If you take a look at source number 2, you see why this is such a big deal. Rabbi Moses Maimonides, no stranger to medicine, when he codifies the laws of kosher slaughter, the laws of shechita, he says, the list of trefot never changes. In other words, my easy answer would have been, okay, so clearly now the animal can survive with this condition. Doesn't work that way. He says, one may not add to this list of trefot at all. For anything that happens to a domestic or wild animal or to a bird, aside from those conditions listed by the sages of early generations and agreed upon in Jewish courts, the creature may live. And even if we know medically that it will not live, I don't care, he says. This list ain't changing. And for all of those listed where they said it is a trefa, even if it appears based on our medicine that these conditions are not fatal and they could live, that one of these conditions, it should say, is not fatal and they could live, we only have that which the sages listed. As Deuteronomy 17:11 says, based on the Torah they will teach you, that's what you follow, that's what you're supposed to do. So, Maimonides has already said, before Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet is ever on the scene, that the list can't change. So what do I do when someone writes me a question saying, but my animal is alive and kicking? What do I tell him? Remember, this is not a minimal question, even for the person asking the question. In other words, I'm looking at this 700 years later, philosophically. Like, well, what do I do with this as a problem of science and religion? He doesn't care about this from a science and religion perspective. The questioner cares about it because why? Yeah, he doesn't want to lose the money that's going to come with his animal. In other words, you're telling me that my animal is a trefa and therefore I can't shecht it. Right? I can't shecht it and sell the meat. Who knows how much money I am losing because you're calling it a trefa. It's alive. It was alive a year ago, and it's alive now. So the questioner doesn't care about major philosophical issues. The questioner cares about his wallet. You're telling me this is a total loss. So look at what Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet writes, and this is an excerpt. It's a long response. I took the parts out that would be most relevant. You can guess what he said based on the buildup that I've given you. Right? He says, response, if you saw or heard one who is lenient and permits a yeteret, this type of condition, or any other situation the sage has listed as a trefa, do not listen to him, do not agree with him, there should not be such in Israel. If you hear that anybody, because that's what the questioner had said, I've heard that some permit, I just want to know your point of view, he says, you got to be kidding me. It appears to me that one who permits this is slandering the words of the sages. I will speak with you about this at length, so that a fence will be built for you and for all who tremble at the word of God, and the words of the holy sages of Israel will not be made like a fence that has been pushed aside, such that a fox could ascend and break through. He says, forget it, pal. No way, and I'm going to explain it, he says. And if there is one whose heart disturbs him, saying that perhaps the sages only spoke of the majority of cases, and most animals experiencing one of the listed trefot will not survive, right? Maybe you could say that they said most animals don't make it. So this is a way to save face, right? Maybe that's the answer. But some of them might survive due to their physical and constitutional strength. No. He says, then you will have canceled our Mishnah's rule. The Talmud stated, none like this live. No exceptions. All of the cases listed by those sages within the view of the Mishnah's author cannot live. You cannot escape one of two possibilities. Either a trefa cannot live, and the fact that this animal lived testifies that it is not a trefa. Or this case resolves the debates about whether a trefa can live and testifies that the law is against the author of the Mishnah, and like the author of the Braita, another source who stated that a trefa can live. In other words, either our Mishnah is wrong, or you must be wrong about the animal. And since the law follows the Mishnah, that only leaves one other possibility. And if you will reply, he says, we're still in source number 3, the last paragraph. And if you will reply, what can we do? We have seen a yeteret of the foot, so apparently it was an extra toe, survive 12 months with our own eyes. So you're going to tell me, but I saw it. He says, yeah, regarding things like that, Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi told Rabbi Yossi ben Nehorai in the Talmud, you depend on that in a separate context. One of the sages said, he's going to laugh, like, you think that's proof? That's what I say here too. Meaning, this is not possible. It is as though you testify that you have seen the impossible. Or, there's another cause. So to here, we ask the witness how he knows the animal had in fact survived that period. Perhaps you forgot or erred, or perhaps you were confused regarding the time. Perhaps you confused this animal for another. For it is not possible for him to testify that this animal was in his sights for the entire 12 months. Right? So he got confused. He came out the next day and he thought this was the original, but in fact it was another animal that also had an extra toe. And if he will strengthen himself in his error and say, no, I love these foreign words, this is what I saw and this is what I will follow, which is a verse from Jeremiah, then we will tell him that it is impossible to slander the words of the sages. This witness and 1,000 like him should be canceled rather than cancel one point of the positions agreed upon by the holy Jewish sages, the prophets and students of prophets, and statements given to Moses at Sinai. And so on. Sandy.
It's puzzling from the Maimonides perspective, because as a medical person, things do change, and sometimes you have to rethink how you're going to treat someone based on how things work. And his rejection of that notion for this troubles me, because sometimes we find out things and we rectify a situation because there's an inherent wrong in
it. Right. So Sandy makes a point, right, that Maimonides is a doctor. But you have to be willing to update that which you thought before based on new evidence, or you're not going to be a good doctor. Right? I think it was John Maynard Keynes, when he was challenged about something that he had said in The Economist. He changed one of his positions, and someone said he had flip-flopped. And he said, what do you do when you get new evidence?
Well, there's another point, too, that disturbs me, and that is, even today we struggle with things that can't be changed. For example, the length of days of a Pesach, or the extra day that mm-hmm. we have here. There's scientific evidence to show there's a reason why we really don't have to be so concerned with 8 days, 7 days, because we can, to the precise second, we can figure out when things start, when things finish. And yet there's no willingness to change that. It's the same kind of an argument.
Right. So you're asking a few questions in one, so I'm going to try to break them out a little bit.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. First, I'm going to make the question stronger in terms of Maimonides. In his medical writings, Maimonides is very willing to identify mistakes of earlier generations. He writes extensively about Galen. Right? Galen, surprisingly, is like 1,000 years before Maimonides, 2nd century. And yet, he's still, stunningly, the last word on many issues when you get to the days of Maimonides. Maimonides writes about his thought, sometimes agrees with it, often disagrees with it. And he's willing to say, you know what, evidence shows that what he's saying is wrong. So when it comes to the medical field, he is willing to change. Not only that, as we'll eventually see, Maimonides is of the belief that some of what the sages wrote in the Talmud, medically, is simply the medicine of their time. It isn't accurate. And so he drops certain things and certain concerns of theirs and says that. So the question really is, why is this thing such a big deal? What is going on in this particular situation? I would distinguish between this case, though, and the last day of the holiday case. And I'm aware it's only a for instance. But the Talmud itself says we're not observing the last day, the extra day of the holiday outside of Israel, because of any doubt about the calendar. Going all the way back to Talmudic times, they could calculate just fine. That wasn't their problem. There were concerns about Jews who would find themselves in situations where they didn't have access to calendar. That was one consideration. And then the other was that it had already been in place as a practice for generations and generations. You're talking about hundreds of years. And so the idea of changing from that minhag, changing from that practice, something which, my grandmother and her grandmother and her grandmother, they all had 8 days. You're going to tell me now we have seven, was anathema.
On Friday, the Pope changed it, and it was a big fissure in the Catholic Church when that happened.
Right. Well,
the same idea. But
he's a Pope. We have other problems with the Pope. But in any case, going back to the case at hand, you're absolutely right. Why in the world is there this resistance? And now let's make it even stronger. By the way, just to note, I'm going to go back to a case I mentioned last week where this is also relevant. I mentioned last week the idea of the 8-month fetus, right? We had said that going back to the Talmud, there was a belief that a fetus born after 7 months of gestation is actually more likely to survive than a fetus born after 8 months of gestation. And that wasn't just our idea. That was common medical knowledge. That it was so, and the theory basically said that there is such a thing as a 7-month fetus, like there's a certain growth rate, and it'll be done after 7, and then there's a 9-month gestation rate, and the fetus will require 9 months. If it's a 7-monther who's held over, so to speak, stays in to cook longer, they'll be okay. If it's a 9-monther that doesn't get the full 9 months, then that's dangerous and the fetus won't survive. This came up as a practical question regarding an issue of paternity. And the question of, well, we know this woman had a child and the child survived, and if it was from this man, then it would be an 8-month fetus. Well, that can't be, because an 8-month fetus doesn't survive. And it became a question of whether the child we were talking about was legitimate or not, depending on how you calculate who the father would be. And again, one of the sages involved, this was not Rabbi Shlomo ben Adar, this is Rabbi Yitzchak ben Sheshet Profet, said, look, this is our tradition, the 8-monther doesn't make it. So therefore it can't be, this is an 8-month fetus.
I just suppose you did make it. You did make it.
That's part of it. There's a lot of discussion about that case. We might come back to it later on in the series. But it's another example of this. But it's even more problematic, because Rabbi Shlomo ibn Adaret himself was of the belief that sometimes physical reality changes over time. He dealt with it. I brought it for you in number 4 in his commentary to the Talmud, dealing with something called Inunita Divarta. It's a section of the animal's lung, which at one point in history, as the Talmud records, was only found in certain animals raised in certain ways. But he writes himself in source number 4, he's dealing with a certain case, and he says, in this matter, nature has changed, and the same thing is true for this Inunita Divarta, this part of the lung, which exists in all of our animals. It's not found in only some of the animals. So he says, the world changes, biology changes over time. So why was he so certain that when it comes to the treifat, it doesn't change? So I turn to the thought of Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, who's also known as Chazon Ish, a major figure in Israel in the middle of the 20th century. He was the one who went to David Ben-Gurion to have the debate about the drafting of women into the IDF. A very significant figure in ways that go far beyond what we're going to discuss right now. But look at what he had to say here in number 5. He says, regarding this issue of the treifot not changing, one should not be shocked. In truth, it appears that God created cures even for treifot. In other words, it's not that a treifot can't live. There are things you can do for an animal with some of these conditions, medically, whatever, nutritionally, whatever it is, such that the animal will survive. But they were not revealed, these cures were not revealed in every generation and every place, meaning sometimes they knew the medicine, sometimes they didn't know the medicine. Some were revealed and forgotten. But all was arranged by God from the beginning of creation. The sages were charged with identifying treifot with their divine inspiration, and it had to happen in what he calls the 2,000 years of Torah, setting the laws of treifot for all generations. The 2,000 years of Torah is a concept that we're going to have to come back to next week, which is that the world lasts for 6,000 years. You've heard this idea? That the world lasts for 6,000 years and it's divided up into units of 2,000 each. So we'll have to talk about that in light of, you know, 13 and a half billion. But the point is that he says that when the Talmud is concluded, the laws of the Trefot are set, and it isn't a matter of being medically correct. Sometimes the law says, I don't care what the medicine says. It's not about the medicine at all. So now I'll turn to you and ask you, why in the world would that be? Why would you have such a basic practical law? This is not a hypothetical up in the air type, you know, angel standing on the head of a pin. This is, are these animals mortally wounded or not? Why would you want your law to be static? Why shouldn't it be flexible based on the current state of our ability to take care of animals? Yeah, Shauna.
Is it similar to a hook where it's something you just accept is the way it is, we might not understand it, and you have to follow it?
So Shauna points out that we have within the Torah a distinction between different types of laws. Some laws we are given reasons for, the Torah will even say it explicitly, and some laws, the other end of the spectrum, the Torah says nothing to explain it whatsoever, and we look at it and we can't figure out what in the world this is about. So the argument goes that maybe this is a chok, the law of the trefa, and the problem with that is that we do know, because we're given definitions of it, this animal can't live. It's not like we're being told, accept it as it is. So again, why would this be set in stone?
Isn't there something where they say it's a shrimp and it's written, don't ask.
Yes, but that's the question: is why should that apply here? This really seems to be very basic. It seems to be such a medical thing. So, to offer a couple of answers, Stephen.
Maybe something happened and it escaped death. That's what's unexplainable. It should be dead, and it isn't dead. We don't have an answer for it.
But the truth of the matter is that what you're telling me is that even if I can come up with a system for keeping one of these animals alive, you're still going to tell me it's a trefa. Not a one shot. But even in, you know, even if this is what we can do at large for all animals with these conditions. Shauna?
So you don't want everybody making up their own rules across generations. You want to have...
Right. So Rabbi Aryeh Carmel, in source number 6, offers an answer, which is along those lines. Basing himself on an idea found in the work called Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch is a 13th century work that was written initially anonymously by a sage writing to his son, telling him, I'm going to provide for you a list of all the 613 commandments and an explanation of each one, and this is for you to study. And it became a very popular work. It's often attributed to someone by the name of Rabbi Aaron Halevi, who was a Spanish scholar of that period. And Rabbi Carmel draws on the thought of Sefer HaChinuch, who's dealing with matters of human authority. Sefer HaChinuch says, sometimes we adopt authority not because we believe that the person in charge is the smartest one or the best diplomat or whatever it is, but just because we need to have one way of doing things. Your system of government will not work if everybody's just going to do whatever is good in their eyes. Right? Think of the parodies of the way that a kibbutz runs itself and everybody, you know, insisting on, you know, they're the one that's right and we're going to debate it out until everybody agrees with me. That doesn't work. You need a leader, even if the leader isn't necessarily right all the time. So that's what Rabbi Carmel draws on here in number 6. And he says, an interesting solution to the problem at hand, and one relevant to our topic, is that of the author of Sefer HaChinuch, who accepts that since human beings are fallible, giving absolute authority to one body of people must sometimes lead to error. He avers, however, that it is better to tolerate one error with everyone relying on a single authority rather than that each person should act with regard to mitzvahs according to his own opinion. This course will lead to disruption of the law, disunity of the people, and complete abrogation of the truth. Right? The alternative is strife. The alternative is schism. So, all right, so we'll say this is my high court, and they're going to make my decision, and that's what we're all going to follow. If we assume, he says, that Rambam, Maimonides, would agree with Sefer HaChinuch on this point, Rambam meaning Maimonides, who wrote that the Trefa doesn't change. If he would agree with the Sefer HaChinuch, which he likely would, because Sefer HaChinuch is a student of the school of Maimonides and often follows his approach, and it's safe to say that they're of the same mind. Then he says the difficulties raised above about this Trefa disappear. By citing the verse from Deuteronomy, meaning if you go back for a second to source number 2, Maimonides quoted the verse, based on the Torah they will teach you. You follow what the high court says. Rambam indicated that halakhic decisions comprised in the Talmud, including the list of trefot, are as binding on Israel as a decision of the Sanhedrin, the high court. Just as a decision of the Sanhedrin cannot be challenged for the reason adduced above, because you need to say, this is the way it is, you can appeal a decision, and they can rehear the case. But you can't decide on your own, I don't like what they said. So the list of trefot cannot be updated. To update the list from time to time in accordance with advances in veterinary medicine might well lead, in theory at least, to an increase in accuracy. But in practice, it will most certainly lead to disruption and confusion in halachic decision-making. Questions of trefot of fowl and animals occur frequently in every Torah-observant household, or did until recently. Right? He's writing in 1998. By 1998, the questions of trefot are occurring in the Empire chicken plant, not in people's homes. But for the vast majority of our history, that's the way it worked. In your own house, you had to deal with it. One cannot expect every local rabbi to be up to date on the latest medical advances, not to speak of differences in medical opinion where there would be no means of resolving. Right? I say that this animal can live. The rabbi down the block says this animal cannot live. Good luck. A fixed list enables him to decide every case with certainty. Paraphrasing the chinuch, we might say, Chazal, our sages, prefer to tolerate some factual errors and gain certainty in the decision-making process. This was simply least common denominator. That's his approach, yeah.
Why do they then encourage a minority opinion? In court, there's a majority opinion and a minority opinion. And also in the Talmud, as I've been led to believe,
yes,
they do list the contrary opinions.
Right. That's a very good question. Why do we bother with minority opinions? Oh, and we love minority opinions, right? The Talmud would be a lot shorter if we just recorded who won. Not to mention, we bring the arguments on both sides. So in a secular court, what's the reason for recording minority opinions?
Precedence for future.
Good. Exactly. Marlene says, for precedent.
Yeah.
Because later on, that argument may turn out to be useful and important. And that's the same point that's made regarding the Talmud. There is a body of Mishnah, one of the volumes of Mishnah, it's rarely learned, unfortunately. It's called Eduyot. The Eduyot means testimonies. And it refers to, literally, when one sage got up in the study hall and said, I heard that so-and-so said this, testifying to sets of rules that he had received as a tradition. And there they ask the question, why do we bother recording minority views? And the answer is either because somebody may come along in a later generation and think he came up with a new argument that no one had considered before and a reason to change things. And by recording the minority view, you can point to it and say, no, we actually did have this conversation and they lost. Or alternatively, because that argument may indeed become useful in a later situation in which we need to look at this case differently. So, for example, there's a principle in Jewish law called hefsed meruba. What is a hefsed in Hebrew? A loss. Meruba, like harbe?
A lot.
A great hefsed meruba means a great loss. And the principle is that in the event that you need to prevent a significant loss, like financial loss, it's possible to follow a minority view. It depends on the particular case at hand. Don't try this at home. But the point is that minority views sometimes have legal standing, even if they didn't win. So we do need to record the minority view. At the same time, when it comes to the decision of who are we going to follow as a nation, what's our policy going to be, we go to the high court and say, what do you say? And they give a ruling. And that, Rabbi Carmel argues, is the rationale here. It will be very challenging to leave this open to change. There's a second argument. Yeah.
This whole thing just sounds to me as if it's err on the side of caution.
Yes.
Yes?
Although,
is that a Jewish thought?
So I would say, actually, yes and no. I shouldn't say yes. Because it's not only err on the side of caution. It's also err on the side of leniency, as it happens. Meaning, Maimonides stated the argument both ways. It's not only if someone tells me this animal is able to live, I don't listen to him, but also if someone tells me that some other animal cannot live, I'm not listening to him either. If he says you should add to the list of trefot, I'm not going to listen to that either. So it's not so much err on the side of caution as it is err on the side of tradition.
So it's not terribly definitive.
Well, it's very definitive. It's so definitive that no one gets to change it. Right? We're going the other way. We're saying that this is your list, you know, and this is my argument, and I'm sticking to it. In terms of whether err on the side of caution is a Jewish idea, I think the answer is yes to that as well. I just don't think it's the case at hand. Meaning we have a principle, safek de'oraita l'chumra. If I'm in doubt regarding a biblical law, I'm supposed to take the strict view in order to make sure that I don't accidentally violate the word of God. As opposed to if I have doubt in a rabbinic matter where we say to go leniently. So there is a concept of erring on the side of caution in certain matters. There's another approach to this from Rabbi Avram Shapira, a major rabbi in Israel, end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st, in which he made a separate argument. I'll just sum it up from number 7 in the interest of time. And he said maybe the answer is because calling an animal a trefa isn't because it's dead or dying, but because it's already very weak. And maybe that's enough to say, therefore it shouldn't be kosher. So that's a separate argument. Therefore, it doesn't actually have to be that the trefa is going to die. But what we've added here in this conversation is I think we've added an additional dimension to the challenge. In addition to the reasons we've mentioned for there to be a clash between Jewish law and scientific discovery, whether matters of philosophy, whether extraneous matters, differences of method, sometimes the law doesn't care about what the observed reality is. Sometimes science isn't the point. So you can give numerous examples for this. I gave a few examples on here. I'm going to take one of them. The other two we may come back to. The middle case that I listed in number 8 is the case of the etrog. When you buy an etrog, you're supposed to check it to make sure there are no blemishes, because the Torah describes the etrog as pre-eitz hadar, which could be rendered as the beautiful fruit of the tree. There are a lot of ways to translate that clause, but you could read it as the beautiful fruit of the tree. It has to be beautiful without defect. You will find people in some communities who will take a jeweler's loop and go over the skin of the etrog to make sure there's no blemish. However, that's not Jewish law. Jewish law says a blemish means that which I can see. If, with my own unaided eye and a normal person's vision, you look at it and you say, this looks complete, there's no further conversation to be had. You don't need to go any further. That's the standard. You'll tell me that scientifically, it does have a defect. We have the ability, with our lenses, ever since Anton von Leeuwenhoek, we have the ability to magnify the surface and to see that something is there. Doesn't make a difference. Give you another example. Jewish law, the laws of keeping kosher, prohibit eating bugs, living things that are not kosher. What if science tells me that there are creatures there that are not visible to the naked eye? The answer is drink up. That's okay. It's not an issue.
Swill broccoli in the whole thing.
So when it comes to checking vegetables, the issue is what can you see with your eye? It's not a matter of... No one should ever be using a microscope to check their vegetables.
Yes, they do. So what
happens? It could be that there are people who do that. There are people who do all sorts of things. That doesn't make them right. I can open up a head of normal romaine lettuce and show you bugs that you can see with your unaided eye. That's what you have to watch out for.
But in a culture, at the synagogue, they don't have broccoli on a menu because...
Right.
They're
worried about the difficulty of checking. What happens is you have to distinguish between two different things, and they're important to distinguish. One is, what does the law demand of me? And the other is, what does practicality demand of me? When I was a synagogue rabbi before coming to Toronto, so we had caterers who operated out of our kitchen. And if one of them wanted to use broccoli, if one of them wanted to use cauliflower, strawberry, certain things that for which checking is intensive, that was an awful lot of work. Now, because we wanted kosher food, and we wanted to be able to have a kosher caterer who people would use, so you put in the hours in order to make sure that that's going to be available. But it's an awful lot of extra work, which also means you're paying people for the time involved. And it's often a lot easier to just say, we don't use these, not because they can't be done in a kosher way, but because it's prohibitively expensive for them to do it. That's a practical decision. That's not a kashrut decision. From the perspective of kashrut, if you can see it, you have a problem. If you can't see it, it's not a conversation.
Can't you say the same about the cow?
Meaning?
If you can't really see the defect that they say.
Oh, they can see the defect. It's an extra whatever it is.
It's
an extra something. Yeah. Yes. It does have to be visible. There are certain trefot that only show up after shkita because they're inside. Yeah. You know, there's a hole in an internal organ. You're not going to know that until you've checked it, and that's why it has to be checked afterwards. Marlene.
I don't know how true that is, but my mother used to tell me, she grew up in Poland, a very religious home, that they had this whole discussion that they couldn't eat tomatoes because they couldn't decide it was a vegetable or a fruit or whatever it was. I don't know the story.
That was their issue.
I don't know. But so what is the issue about tomatoes?
I mean, there were issues with vegetables in pre-war Europe in terms of infestation, like worm infestation. That's the only thing that I am familiar with. Not a dispute about whether a tomato was a fruit or a vegetable. I'm not familiar with one. If you could find out more about it, I can look around, but I'm not familiar with one. I'm going to go to the second topic now because there's so much to say, and I want to get to Copernicus this week, at least on some level. So what we've seen is another reason why science and Torah can clash, and that is because sometimes the rule that we're given is simply, this is what we do, and it isn't about what you observe. But now I want to get to the challenge of Copernicus in the 16th century and then forward from there, because don't think it's only the 16th century. This is actually, this goes beyond that. I'm actually going to start a new